It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the No Chof Des podcast. I'm your host, Stel, and my guest, all right, you guys should know him. If you've been watching Premier League football, Championship football for a long time, is former Irish international, Simon Cox. How you doing, mate?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, great to have you on the podcast, mate. How are you living at the moment? I see it's all nice and sunny out there.
Living really well, mate. Living really well out here in Australia. Things are a little bit better over here than they are in the UK, so can't complain too much.
Good to hear, mate. Now, I know I'm going to have a lot of Omonia fans saying, Simon Cox, we recognise that name. He played with Matt Derbyshire, didn't he, at Nottingham Forest?
Yeah, mate. Yeah, we played together for a couple of years, yeah.
How was he? He's a good boy, isn't he? He's a good boy.
Yeah, he's a good boy, mate. He's very energetic. Listen, he done really well when he went over to Omnia, so he can't complain with that. And now he's out here with me in Australia, and he's doing okay. So we seem to cross paths quite a few times.
Do you play golf with him as well? I've never seen him play golf, to be fair, on his Instagram and
that. Yeah. Silly, he's not a golfer. he's got too many kids to worry about. Yeah, get 4 hours of playing golf.
Very true. Very true. So let me get this straight. You've been in Australia for about a year now, I'd say. Is that right? Yep. Western Sydney Wanderers. And how do you find the quality of football in comparison to, say, the Championship? Because I've spoken to several people that have played out there, and they tell me that some teams play very high-intensity football, whereas others are very, I wouldn't say clumsy, but it's almost as if they're like a League Two, a conference side.
Yeah, it's probably the question I get asked most, and anybody who comes over here gets asked the exact same question. Mm. And the way I answer it is the heat and humidity plays a massive part. We play games at 7 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, purely and simply because of the heat and humidity. What I would say is that the standard is very good. Purely and simply because every team tries to play football the right way. They try to pass we don't really have the 6'6", 6'7" centre forward who, goes from back to front and get around it in second balls. It's that everybody tries to pass the ball and play the right way. So that's a good start for the league. There's going to be some teams who are better than others. But over here, it's a very good standard. I would probably say it's around a sort of top end League One to the bottom end Championship sort of level. But it would be a better level if we played in the UK climate, purely and simply because you could run around a little bit easier and you wouldn't be blowing out your ass.
After one sprint. Crikey. Well, look, mate, let's talk about the early days. You started off at Reading. That's the club that, your first club. You signed your pro forms at, I presume. You went through academy level. Correct me if I'm wrong, but was that the time when Steve Coppell was head coach?
Yeah.
First team. So they had the likes of Leroy Lita, Sonks, blimey, Glenn Little, and they had a fantastic season when they won the championship at a canter. That was 2008, wasn't it? But you hadn't broken into the first team by that time, had you? Because you went on loan to Brentford, is that right?
Yeah, so I was a squad player that year. I played a handful of games. The season they won the league, 106 points, still not to be beaten. You named a few of the players. There was a lot more where, you know, it was a team, no superstars in it. It was a hard working team, and like you said, they won it at a canter. But yeah, I hadn't really broken into that team. Hadn't really broken into the Reading first team squad either. So I had to go out on loan, and Steve Coppell's allegiance with Brentford, because he'd been there as a manager, as a player, and had a good relationship with them. We used to send a few players to Brentford. We got a few. Steve Sidwell used to be at Brentford as a player. Sonks used to be at Brentford as a player. So we used to have a good relationship with them. So first loans, if good enough, would go to Brentford.
Brilliant. I spoke to Sonks, when was it? About 4 or 5 months ago, and he was telling me about his move from Brentford to Reading, and that fantastic season when obviously got promoted to the Premier League, and the players that he played against, et cetera, et cetera. And going to Brentford, that must have been an eye-opening experience for you, because, again, I don't think it was round about the time when Mad Dog was in charge, Martin Allen. But you had Lloyd Owusu there, was a great striker, and he's actually in Australia at the moment, isn't he?
Good friend of mine, yeah.
Yeah, top bloke, top bloke. And Neil Shipperley, another seasoned pro. Wasn't he there at the same time as you?
I don't think I had chips. I don't think so.
No? Okay, fair enough. So,
I might have done. It was such a long time ago. My memory's not brilliant.
Fair enough. Well, look, you had Lloyd there. So what kind of an influence was he? Because he played for a lot of big sides.
Yeah, so I first met Lloyd at Reading, going through the youth ranks, and he was obviously there before going to Brentford. And he was brilliant. Like, he was the one that, as soon as I went there, or even before I was going there, he was asking, you know, do you want to come in on loan and stuff like that? And, you know, it'd be good to play alongside you and help you and develop and stuff. And I was like, brilliant. As soon as I got there, the thing is, I went to Brentford and nobody really knew what I was at Reading in terms of a player. So I went to Brentford as a central midfield player. Like Reading at the time didn't know whether I was a central midfield player, a number 10 or a number 9. So, you know, trial and error, we went to Brentford and I went as a central midfield player. Leroy Rossignol was the manager at the time. Things didn't go so well. And I didn't really do that well at all. Played a lot of games, but didn't do too well. It was a completely different way of playing, and a completely different thing that I was used to. I was obviously used to playing, you know, reserve team football, under 23s football, whatever you want to call it now, to then going in and playing first team football for a team that needs points to survive, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it really opened my eyes. It was my first loan, my first set of games in the Football League, and it was a big learning curve for me.
I think you had four managers that season, didn't you? There was Leroy Rossignol, there was Scott Fitzgerald, there was Barry Quinn? Was it Barry Quinn was there? No?
I mean, you're doing research. I'm trying to think. I remember Fitz. Fitz is now at Millwall as well, but I still sort of keep in touch with him. I think he was my last manager, to be honest.
Right. Because I think he played for Wimbledon at one point, didn't he, in his career? Yeah. Was it Wimbledon? Yeah. But with Leroy Rossignol, it's an interesting one for me, because I know his son is coaching at Derby at the moment, isn't he? He's got his coaching badge. He's coaching
with Rooney, yeah.
So how can you see? I mean, did you what was Leroy Rossini like as a manager? Because I know as a player, he was a fantastic footballer, but it's almost as if he's one of those players who turned into management, gave it a go at a few clubs, and has kind of gone in the wilderness since.
Yeah, I mean, he does a lot of media stuff and that now, but as a manager, like, I thing is, I was used to Steve Coppell,
right,
as a manager. So I knew that Steve was the kind of person who didn't really do a great deal of management. He let his coaches do that, Wally Downs, Kevin Dillon. And then I go to Brentford, and Leroy is the manager, he's the coach, he's, you know, everything that you'd sort of, I didn't want or didn't need at Reading. So he was okay. You know, it was tough because for me, it was like I said, my first real manager at club level, and it just didn't work out for one way or another, one reason or another. It just didn't work out. And like you said, he gave it a go at a couple of other clubs and never really seemed to get to grips of management, and now he's got a nice gig at doing the media stuff, and Liam is doing really well at Derby. So, you know, sometimes you don't always follow in your father's footsteps, but hopefully Liam's a little bit more detailed than Leroy is or was, and you know, listen, he's got a good mentor right now, and he's got a good opportunity with Rooney at Derby.
100%. Well, you ended up at Northampton on loan, and at that club, you had people like Sean Dyche, Ian Jess was there, I believe. Even Lee Harper, Harps, good mate.
Yeah.
John Gorman was the first head coach, I believe, or the manager at the time, was
not
he?
Not mine, no. Oh? No, he wasn't mine. No, I had, first team coach.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, he was. Yeah, no, I thought you meant manager. Yeah, sorry. First team coach. Stuart Gray was the manager. John Gorman, yeah.
So what was it like working with those two? Because Gorman was with Glenn Hoddle back in Swindon and for national team, wasn't he? England.
Yeah.
What was it like at that level?
So, it was great. Again, I went to Brentford as a midfield player. I went to Northampton as a striker for six or seven games, and I went and thoroughly enjoyed it. Listen, it was really tough. It was coming towards the end of the season. Northampton were doing okay. They weren't doing great. But I went in for the last sort of seven or eight games of the season. People like Bradley Johnson were at the club at the time. You know, obviously gone on to have a really good career. And it was a club that was... Steve Cottrell was all about fitness. Mm-hmm. Very much like... We two goalkeepers were as fit as the outfield players. You know, we had a running track around the training pitch, which I always think is never nice because you know what's coming. But it was one of them that he brought me in and gave me the opportunity to try and score goals and establish myself as a striker.
And at that level, I think, was it Scott McLeish got, how many goals was it that season? 13, 14? When you're looking at a player like him that was banging in goals, you're thinking, well, is this a club I'm going to get an opportunity for? Or do you felt, well, I can go back to Reading and still ply my trade there?
Well, I think he was injured at the time I went in.
Right.
Which is, I think, one of the reasons why I got bought in. Because I don't remember him playing that much in the six games or seven games I was there. So... But Dyche was there, and he welcomed me as you can imagine. Sean Dyche would invite everybody else into a group, and
it wasn't like a crazy gang kind of thing where you set fire to your clothes, was it?
No. I remember the first day I walked in, and I was sat there all sheepish and quiet in the corner having a bit of breakfast, and he sort of walked in and sat down, and he's gone, because I was obviously like really naive at the time. He was gone. We signed some young little punk from Reading, I think, is like, and I was just went, oh yeah, that's me. And he went, shut up, mate.
That booming voice even now, isn't it?
Yeah. Sounds like he swallowed an exhaust pipe, doesn't it?
My mate compares him to Louis Armstrong.
But no, he was great. And he showed me the way like a senior pro should be. You know, him, Ian Taylor, remember Ian Taylor, the central midfield player at Villa? Yeah, he was there playing his last games, and you know, two top pros who did exactly what they needed to do in their last days and did it really well and made sure that everybody, you know, was up to a level and up to a standard that was required. So it was a really good time, really good grounding and education for me.
Brilliant. Do you think that is what you would have needed at Reading when you were breaking through the first team, that kind of, I don't know, older head to look after you and maybe point you the right direction?
Yeah, but I think I had that. I had that in abundance at Reading, to be fair. Likes of Graham Murty would always be that kind of sort of father figure you could lean on. You know, he was club captain as well, so it made it easier to speak with him, anything that you need. Played golf with him loads of times as well. So, you know, you got 4 hours to chat absolute rubbish to him if you needed to. But I think Reading were in a completely different position to what Northampton were in. Northampton were very young with a group of experienced players. Reading were, like I said, trying to go for promotion and with a lot of, you know, experienced heads around the place. So there probably wasn't a time for me, you know, an inexperienced young up and comer. Compared to what Northampton was, it was more of an up-and-coming group of people. So I had it, but probably felt more comfortable at Northampton, leaning on the people, seeing the experienced heads do exactly what they do, compared to just being what you'd call normality at Reading with all the experienced boys.
Brilliant. So Swindon come knocking. Now, I know you went there on loan. You had a few managers there in your first stint. I think Storrock was there, or David Byrne. I think Maurice Malpass at one point was
Maurice Malpass, yeah.
He played for Dundee United. I remember him in the Scottish Cup final in the early 90s. So what was it like having to leave Reading? Because this is the club that you grew up. I know you had a couple of loan spells, but did Steve Coppell take you to one side and say, you know, I think it's best for you to move on because we've got enough strikers here, or is it for your development? Was he good like that with you?
It was a bit of both, really. Really a bit of both. It was one of those that Swindon came knocking. So I'd obviously gone to Northampton as a striker, done okay, scored my first few goals in the Football League. Season pretty much came to an end at a really wrong time for me. Came back to pre-season with Reading, then knew I wasn't going to play because, you know, you had Leroy Leiter, you had Shane Long, you had Kevin Doyle, Dave Kitson, you know, all of these centre forwards who are ahead of you, and you know that you're not going to play. So the best thing for me, for my development, was to go out on loan again. I sat down with Steve Coppell and I said, look, am I going to get a chance? And he said, probably not. You know, even if we play cup games and first two strikers are probably Dave Kitson and Kevin Doyle. Second two is probably Shane and Leroy. Then you're on the bench. So even in cup games, you'd be on the bench. You probably wouldn't get a chance to play. You'd come on, but is that enough for you? And, you know, are you going to develop enough if you just sit and play 20 minutes at the end of a cup game? So the best thing for you is probably to go out on loan again. So I had, Lloyd Owusu was at Yeovil at the time. He phoned me and he was like, would you come down to Yeovil? And I was like, it's a bit of a long way there, I'll be honest with you. Not a great deal of anything around there.
So no clubs, nothing like that.
No. We sat in a Holiday Inn, just sitting there twiddling my thumbs and that. So I was like, bit of a long way away. And then Swindon came in. Paul Sturrock was the manager, and he said, would you come in and join us? And I was like, it's down the road, I can live at home. I said, yeah, absolutely. So I came in, and he was brilliant. Massively old school manager, Terror Tuesdays, running up and down the field, all that sort of stuff, but got you ridiculously fit. And we played a decent style of football until he decided that Plymouth was the the club that he'd obviously supported or managed as a and had successful times, and he left us and went to Plymouth and left us with Maurice Malpass in the end.
But it's incredible how you mention head coaches who have very old methods, because, you know, you had Steve Coppell that was very, I'd say he was very, he evolved a lot, did Steve Coppell, with the way that football changed, because football changes every year, doesn't it? Every minute of the day. And you've had all these different managers, and then you look at someone like Paul Sturrock, and then I remember Swindon getting Paolo Di Canio as a head coach years later, and I'm hearing stories about him and how he used to batter his players. I think they went on a 7-week pre-season tour, and they basically trained every single day bar the last day.
Army camp.
You know about those, yeah?
Yeah, I've been in a few of them, mate. Yeah, no, it was just the way the football was at the time. Mm. You know, if you think about it now, there's not really many old school managers around, even, you know, Premier League down to sort of League Two, Conference. They're all new. You know, been in the game for 5-10 years, have been probably ex-players, a lot of them ex-players who have seen the old school that I'd seen. And like you said, football evolves. So you have to evolve. You can't get away with sticking two poles in either side of the training ground now and saying run, because players are they're smarter than that now. They don't. Like, because you have to understand why you're doing things now. And I remember my pre-season at Swindon when I signed there permanently, and that was it. The physio, he drove around the training ground in his car to get the amount of miles and meters clocked up that we had to do in training in the pre-season running. And it was literally four poles in the side of, around the training ground, and it was run until, you know, I blow the whistle, and that was it. Like, don't get me wrong, we were ridiculously fit, but when the ball came out, we weren't great. And that's the difference now, is you get your fitness in, you know, with sports science and everything. Now it's, you get all of that in with them, but now the coaches are proper coaches. They teach you. They make you understand why, and you know what you're doing it for, and all that sort of stuff. And it's a much easier and better experience now than it was when I was coming through, and it was run after the person in front of you.
So, when was the last time you did a bleep test then?
Oh,
that long ago, yeah.
Yeah, a long time ago, mate. Yeah, yeah. I've seen the back of them. Thank God.
No worries. All right. Okay. Well, I'm glad you mentioned your permanent move to Swindon, because the next question I was going to ask you, do you remember this?
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
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 2009 Sky Sports News. I remember this video. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Right. Okay. So you scored 3 hat tricks in 3 separate games. Right.
Yeah.
And you had this feature on Sky Sports News, wasn't it? And you had to go around doing that, stick up the number 3 to the groundsman, to your teammates, to the manager. Yeah. Well, see, the thing is, when I saw that, I was like, you know what? That was so like planned, wasn't it? It wasn't like you just said, yeah, I'm going to do it. You know, they said, you got to do this, you got to do that. Now you look back on it now, do you cringe a little bit?
Oh, mate. You know what, right? I was on YouTube the other day, and you know, sometimes you get something that you've watched or seen or been in like years and years ago, and you look at it and you go, ah, oh, what are you doing? That was that moment. But to be fair, that was what it was back then. Twitter was literally, I remember sitting in a restaurant, like a Frankie and Benny's or whatever, and one of my teammates at the time, he was like, I've just joined this social media platform called Twitter. And I was like, leave that alone. Like, I was still on Facebook and MySpace, I think, at the time.
Oh, yes. MySpace. Lovely.
Bebo. And he's coming out with Twitter. And I was thinking, nah, what? Leave this alone. So there was no like promote, like sort of self promotion. You had to get on Sky, you know, unless you were sort of, you know, the big boys or whatever, who would have, you know, the clubs and that do the social media stuff or anything else like that. It was none of it. And I remember Gary Cottrell came down from Sky, and he was like, you know, what kind of person are you, kind of like serious person, are you kind of funny person, outgoing person? And I was like, look, you know, you tell me.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you tell me, and then I'll let you know whether we can do it or not. And he said, look, you know, you've done something incredible. So we want to do something that's a little bit fun, a little bit enjoyable, but, you know, you might get a bit of stick for it. And I was like, listen, I mean, get a stick every minute you walk down the street.
Probably seen worse, man. Especially
on the territory. So it was cringe. I think the one thing I think I look back now is the clothes, the baggy clothes and that. I think that's the one thing that I look back.
Like PJ and Duncan. I was like, what's that? He's 1999 or 90.
Yeah. listen, it was one of them, and it was good times, mate. Like I say, it was one of those things that happens, and self-promotion right there. And then
to get on
Sky and have that and show an accomplishment like 3 hat tricks in a season was something that you can't turn down.
Of course, man. And at that level, the thing is, people talk about the Premier League and the Championship and you know, obviously they're different leagues, but regardless of which level you're playing at, scoring 3 hat tricks in 3 separate games, that's nothing to turn your nose up on. And to be fair, Giza, like when I saw your goals, because like, I've been following football for a long time and seeing your goals in the Premier League and Championship, et cetera, the type of goals you scored kind of reminded me like the modern day Lee Trundle, because Trunz was always scoring like worldies. And the goals that you scored, there's one goal that you scored, I think it was against Hereford. You were running away from goal and yet you still managed to back heel it in the back of the net.
I was offside then. Thank God for VAR.
I'm glad you're admitting now. Was that part of your game? Were you just one of those players where you just thought, I'm just going to, I see the goal, I sniff the goal, that's it, boom.
Yeah, no, that goal, because I remember that goal, because I was offside. I literally did that because in my head I was offside. It was going to be chalked off and I just flicked it back purely and simply on the basis that I knew it wasn't going to count. You know, if it had gone in the stands, it wouldn't have mattered to me because I knew in my head I was offside. But that season, I scored 32 goals, right? 29 in the league. And it was one of those seasons that anything I hit went in. And you don't get them often at all. Mm. And to be honest, I probably haven't had that enough since then. I've done okay. But
was that a confidence thing though? Was that a confidence thing more than anything? No,
I just think I had a team around me that knew exactly the way I played and I knew exactly what I was getting every day in every game. I had to work hard, obviously. But I have this conversation with the manager out here at the minute and the way that football has evolved and players have evolved, you're not the sole goal getter. You're part of a team who gets goals. And in that team, I had two wingers who would cross the ball. I had a strike partner who was a, you know, big 6'3" centre forward who would hustle and bustle and I would just pick up little bits and my sole job was pretty much 6-yard box, 18-yard box, get on the end of things and score goals.
Hold on, you scored the goal from like 35 yards against Walsall.
You get them.
Oh, come on, you're too modest now. I'm not having it.
But that was it. Like, it was one of those where, like I say, confidence wasn't an issue in that season. It was literally, you know, I got off the mark first game, continued into the second game. We played QPR in the League Cup. Scored in that, continued into the next one, scored in that. And it was then I was on a roll. You know, I looked at my game back then and it was just simple. There was none of this, you know, coming off short, turning, running at people, creating any of that. It was 18-yard box, goals. That was your sole job. And it was just that season that everything I hit went in. And you, like I say, you don't get them very often, but when they do, when you do get them, they seem to be very good.
There you go. And that attracted the attention of West Brom. And they forked out £2 million for you. I think that effectively saved Swindon, didn't it? Really think about it.
Yeah, I think it was one of those that, you know, I would walk around the training ground or the stadium. We didn't have a training ground. We should walk around the stadium, get changed at the training the stadium, and we'd have to do press and things like that. And it was every day they would come to me and say, "Oh, you've been linked with X, Y, and Z club this week or today or tomorrow, whatever." And you know, is there any news? Where are you going? What are you doing? And I was like, I said, I don't know. I literally didn't know until 2 or 3 days before I signed for West Brom. I had to make a decision. I had a really good relationship with the owner at the time, Andrew Fitton. And he sat down with me and, you know, there was no agents, no one involved. It was me and him. We sat down because we had a decent relationship. Danny Wilson was the manager at the time, sat down with him. And it was the decision to go to West Brom that I made, purely and simply because they'd just been relegated from the Premier League. Knew that they were sort of seen as the yo-yo club. Used to probably good chance of them getting promoted back to the Premier League. And you know what young up and coming player doesn't want to get promoted to the Premier League. So that was a big part of my decision. Nervous as hell when I walked through the door. Obviously full of confidence because of what I just achieved, but knew that I wasn't probably going to hit that exact same number again this year, but knew that I would have to learn and develop my game massively, because what worked in League One with Swindon potentially wouldn't work in the Championship with West Brom. So it was a tough time, but you know, one that, you know, I'd never take it back.
Well, for me, it was quite interesting because Roberto Di Matteo was head coach at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And you'd have thought that a foreign manager coming into a Championship side, he wouldn't go for British, you know, he wouldn't go for British players, but it's almost as if he immersed himself in the club's culture and thought, right, we've got a budget, let's bring in a certain amount of players. And obviously you banged 29 goals the previous season. So he's probably thinking, right, this guy knows what it takes to get us goals. And I think you had like Bednar in the team, Chris Wood, I believe, Ishmael Miller. Yeah. But then you had the likes of Mulumbu, Jonathan Greening, Robert Corran, Chris Brunt. So this team had the Premiership experience, but they also had the players such as yourself that were up and coming that could score goals at that level. So when you step out on the pitch at Hawthorns on your first team debut, what are you thinking straight away? Because obviously it's a huge crowd, but you were kind of used to that at Reading anyway.
Yeah, so it was first of all, I'd say that Di Matteo signed off on my sign-in. I don't think he brought me in.
No.
It was a decision that I think was made before him. And I think he just had to give the okay to bring me in. Because Tony Mowbray was the manager at West Brom before, obviously he went up to Celtic, and I was watched that season at Swindon by Tony Mowbray, his assistant Mark Venus, his other assistant, the chief scout, the director of football at West Brom, and every single one of them said yes, bring him in. Tony Mowbray comes and watched me, Leighton Orient, we got beat 1-0, I didn't play that well, and he went back and went, no, I don't want him. But then I think as soon as Tony Mowbray left to go to Celtic, I think I was still on the radar of the club, and I was pretty much bought in by the club, and Robbie just had to give the okay to it.
Sorry to cut you off there. It's interesting you say that because I was talking to Steve Cabba that used to play at Watford. Then he was signed by, I think it was AD Boothroyd, if I remember correctly, this conversation, because I spoke to him many years ago about this. And he was saying to me that AD Boothroyd signed him, and then a few months later, he said to him, I don't know why I signed you. I've changed my mind on you. So Di Matteo's obviously brought you in. What kind of a conversation are you two having? If you know deep down that it wasn't him that signed you, are you thinking, well, I'm on hiding to nothing before I've even started?
Well, I first asked that question of, did you want me? Because the first thing is, if he didn't want me, then I didn't know why I was there. And he was like, no. Like, I've okayed this. I seen you last year because he was MK Don's manager, so I played against him.
So this is what I was trying to get at, because I thought, well, you know, obviously he'd seen you play and you've had that conversation. So he had some faith in you, or a lot.
Yeah. So that was it. So I played against him, and obviously then he became the manager, and that was it. It was a conversation we had, sat down, and I was like, you know, what kind of manager are you? What do you want from me? You know, all of the sort of standard questions that any player should really ask his manager. And as long as he was okay with me being there in terms of signing, and he didn't think I was taking up a space that he thought he would fill with somebody else, then that was fine. Then it was then down to me and trying to get in the team. Like you said, some of the players that we had there were going to be hard to replace. And it was it took me a little while to get used to being at that level and playing at that level. I mean, I think my first game, my first start was Plymouth at home, and thought I did okay. And then the next game I was out of the team, and I was used to playing 90 minutes every week to then playing 190 minutes of being out of the team. So I knocked on his door and said, like, what, you know, why was I out of the team on the weekend? And he was like, look, I thought you did okay. I just think you need to sort of relax and let loose a little bit and enjoy your football again. Go back to what you were doing last year. And I got a chance to play in the cup and scored in the cup, and then played in the league against Watford, scored in that one. And then I found myself getting back onto that role again. And it was tough. We had people like Scott Carson, who was an England international at the time, in the dressing room, and you sat there across the dressing room from him, and you're thinking to yourself, I was playing in League One last year and you were playing in front of 90,000 at Old Trafford last year. Do you know what I mean? And
wasn't it Liverpool before that as well? Did he go to Liverpool after?
Yeah.
Before, yeah.
But like these are the sort of, you know, things that I always think now, going back, do I look back and think, should I, would I, could I do anything better, or could I have done anything easier? And I don't know if I could. I had to grow up quick. You know, like I say, I had to evolve my game, but that was part and parcel of it.
Well, it was an incredible season for West Brom. You guys got promoted, so it was their first attempt back into the Premier League. I know you guys finished second. What were the celebrations like? Because I'm sure you've been asked, sorry, so many questions about the actual league campaign. But when I look at that squad, Dean Kiely, all these other players, I'm thinking, that must have been...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
In a heavy night out.
No.
Really?
Honestly, really? That's one thing that really, really disappointed me. Like I expected I'd never been promoted in my life apart from like being a part of the Reading team, and even that was a, you know, we had open top bus at that stage, but never, we had a party at the club and stuff like that, but we never, you know, the days of what they're like now, and you get promoted and you go to Vegas and you live it up for 5 days, you know, on the club and stuff, that wasn't part of it back then.
I remember seeing Stuart McCall fall off a car drinking in Sheffield United.
Brilliant. I remember that as well. That was on Soccer AM every week. But no, it wasn't. It was we won the, or we came second. We got promoted away at Doncaster. We got the bus back. We decided we would meet as many of us as we can. We'd meet in that Birmingham New Street, where some of the bars and that are. We would meet and have a few drinks and stuff. But in terms of the end of season trip or anything else like that, it was none of that.
Is that because of the manager, though? Do you think it's because of Di Matteo?
No. I just think I don't think the lads overly socialised too much together. You know, you would go for dinner or have a few beers or whatever, not regularly, but every so often. So trying to say, let's get a, you know, a trip to Marbella or a trip to Vegas or, you know, anywhere, you know, could be Benidorm. It doesn't really matter. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're all together, you're enjoying yourself. And, but there was, yeah, there was none of that. So that was a bit of a disappointment, I'll be honest, because I was thinking to myself, like, this is where, like, I want to see.
One, yeah.
But no, there was none of that.
Wow. Okay. That's a surprise. That's a surprise.
Nah, it was a big one for me as well. Don't worry.
Mate. All right. So first season in the Premier League wasn't great for West Brom, or the first half of the season anyway. And I forgive me for bringing this up, but didn't he, Di Matteo, hook you after 15 minutes during the Blackpool game?
Yeah, but that was because we had a man's
call, right? That was right. Okay, because it is me thinking maybe going back to the whole should I have signed him, not have signed him, and then obviously taking out on you for the poor results.
No, we had a game in the cup against Leicester, scored two. Then there was a big talk about whether I would play the Blackpool game, and I remember talking to Stephen Reid at the time, and he was like, "Yeah, you'll 100% you'll play." You know, you can't not play after that, and you know, you're in form and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, sound okay. So me in my head, I was like, just keep working the week leading up to it. We got up to Blackpool, and then it was like first Premier League start, you know, live on Sky, 15 minutes in, sending off, number goes up, and you sat there going, that was rough. That was tough. Because I felt like it would have been a really good game for me as well, because of, you know, Blackpool were, you know, a sort of team that we needed to beat, or we would, you know, if we wanted to stay in the Premier League, these are the sort of teams you sort of set your sights on and doing well in. And then when I think it was Gonzalo Yara got sent off in the corner flag, like two-footed your man in the corner flag, and that was him. He was done, and then that was me. I was done. So I walked in the dressing room and just went to him. I was like, "Cheers." But then I think Robbie felt a little bit bad for me because we played Man City the next game. I don't know if it was a cup game or a league game, but I played the full 90 minutes. So I think he felt a bit bad for me.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. Well, it didn't work out for him. And then Roy Hodgson came in, a manager that, oh, blimey, managed Malmo, Inter Milan, the Swiss national team. Been there, seen it, done it. Yeah. How much of an influence was he on your career? Because I know that you made your Republic of Ireland debut during his tenure at West Brom. So I get the feeling he had a lot to do in terms of your development.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. He was fantastic. Really, really, really good. Exactly what we needed at that time. You know, Robbie, for his credit, wanted to play good football, but tactically and defensively probably wasn't as sound as he needed to be for the Premier League anyway, for the Championship, because we had one of the better teams, we could get away with it probably. But in the Premier League, it's a completely different kettle of fish. Then Roy Hodgson comes in, who, as everybody probably knows, he's more defensive-minded and very tactically astute, in terms of we do the exact same session pretty much every day. It's with the sole focus of being defensively sound. And he came in and he was brilliant. He got us to a really high finish. I think we finished eighth or ninth. And as you mentioned, I made my Republic of Ireland debut under him. And I remember, because I played a lot of games under Roy. I think for some reason, he really liked me. Thought that he could trust me in the games and I wouldn't let him down. So that was always nice to have. But I remember getting the call to say that there was a chance of me going and playing for Ireland. And I sat down with him and I was like, I said, what do you think? And he said, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I said, look, I'm playing. I'm really enjoying myself. I'd love to represent my country at international level. And he was like, look, go, do it. Why are you sort of hesitating? And I was like, I'm just wanted to find out your thoughts on it. You know, whether it would take away from my game time here or, you know, whether you thought it would be a bit too much on me or anything else like that. And he was like, no, I think you'd be fine. Go and be adored by millions of people, you know, for your country and do really well. And that sort of sat well with me. And me and Roy have had a really good relationship from that point.
So effectively, it's not just the tactical side, but it's his man management, because we've seen him do so well at Crystal Palace. And while they go through a bad run of form, you can see the likes of Wolf Zaha, you know, they've kind of thrived under him. Andros Townsend, Ibrahim Eze, who's been fantastic since joining from Queen's Park Rangers. So I know, look, the Liverpool spell and the England spell kind of put a blot in his copybook, but I think both situations, they're like a poison chalice. Liverpool were going through such a horrible stage of their history with rubbish owners, with crap signings. No disrespect, but it's a fact. He was on hiding to nothing. And then with the England national team, well, when was the last manager that actually succeeded at national team level for England? 1966, because that's all we keep hearing. I'm not even lying. Like, when, what? Yeah. The what's that trophy that they won in 98 before the France World Cup? You know, some international friendly tournament. They haven't won anything at senior level. So any manager that comes in is obviously going to be a hiding to nothing. So again, I'm deviating from my question here. So in terms of the man management, would you say that Roy Hodgson was one of the best that you had?
Absolutely, yeah. He would give everybody 5 minutes a day, you know, and that 5 minutes, you know, it doesn't sound a lot, but that 5 minutes to, you know, someone who's playing or someone who's not playing, even more to the point, and just asking how you are, how your family is, you know, how your kids are, if you've got kids, where are you at, what, you know, what you're thinking, and then just that 5 minutes of even asking him questions in terms of where do I sit. You know, am I doing enough? Do I need to do more? That sort of thing. And he would be open and honest with everybody. You know, if you're not playing, he would go, look, you know, you're not playing at the minute because he's doing more than you, or we're doing really well as a team right now, and I can't, you know, mix that up at the minute. And you can't help but be okay with that. You have to, you know, you might not like it because you're not playing, or you know, whatever, or you don't like what he says, but ultimately the honesty from him and just saying, you know, and just having that 5 minutes with him was gold dust. So he was really good at it and keeping and making sure that everybody was on his page and everybody got 5 minutes, which was, you know, gold dust, I said.
Brilliant. And you scored that worldie at White Hart Lane as well. Happy with that one?
Yeah, my one and only.
It's a great strike though.
Oh, if you're going to score one, you might as well do it properly, yeah?
Absolutely. Top bins. Keeper had no chance. I think he just looked at it and walked across. Like, oh,
I don't know what he's waving at.
Brilliant. All right. Well, look, let's quickly talk about... Actually, no, let's not quickly talk about it. I want to talk about Republic of Ireland and your stint there, because, you know, I think it was Trapattoni that gave you your debut. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, again, another old school manager, but I'm sure his temperament was much different to Roy Hodgson's. I've seen Trapattoni lose his shit when he was Bayern Munich head coach. And I'm sure he did something similar for the Irish national team. But before we discuss that, is it me, or was Killian Sheridan called up the same time as you? Was Sheridan ever...
I never played with him.
No, because I know he played under Trapattoni, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway, talk to me about this crazy Italian guy that sends shivers down a lot of people's spines.
You say that, and I never saw that.
No?
No. So I watched the exact same YouTube clip of him losing his shit with Bayern, and I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. You're not going to do something.
It's mentality, then. It must be a senior mentality. Must be.
Yeah. But he... But listen, when I got called up, the likes of Robbie Keane, Damien Duff, Shay Given, Richard Dunn...
That's some team already, man. That's some team.
You know... That's your spine of your team, pretty much. It's a team that ran itself. Robbie would basically do everything. You know, we'd obviously have team meetings and stuff like that. My first game I remember was Northern Ireland. So massive derby, biggest rivalry, split of two countries, or one country into two. Robbie, you know, the Trapattoni, he stood up and said his little piece, and then he gave the floor to Robbie, and Robbie was as passionate as anything, and he was like, we fucking win this. Like, there's no not winning this. We win this. And we end up going out and winning 5-1 or something like that. And
5-0 when you scored in it. How could you forget, mate?
I was going to give him a chance. You give him at least one goal. But I remember I scored in it. Don't worry about that. but that was it. It was a team that, like I say, ran itself. The older heads, the experienced heads in the national team at the time, would, you know, we would obviously put Trapattoni would put sessions on, but his English was terrible. It wasn't great at all.
Translator?
Not on the pitch. He had Marco Tardelli as his assistant.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Who's obviously World Cup winner, legend. Italian, you know, absolute god. English was better, but still not at the level that you would, you know, you can't really sit down and, you know, converse in the detail that you would need to.
What training sessions like then?
They were pretty standard, like boxes, then a little bit of possession and games at the end. That was pretty much it. There was no real tactical work. We would do a bit of shape and set pieces the day before a game, but sessions were pretty standard, mate. There were no, you know, we didn't have sports science or anything at the time. But, yeah, there was no real video of training or anything else like that. So you wouldn't be able to get clips, or, you know, the guy who would do the video analysis would all be on the opposition. And we would go out accordingly. We obviously felt that we were, you know, for especially the first 6 or 7 games of my time at Ireland, I always looked at us and thought, well, we're miles better than, you know, than who we were playing against. Like I said, you look at the names that I just reeled off, and you think, you look at the teams that we were playing against and the players that say they had, and I'd back us every day of the week. And that was the mentality that I had when we walked in. It was then when we went and played against the Spains and the Italys and the, you know, the top teams, is when you look at us and think, well, now we need to be tactically astute. And under Giovanni, because of his English, it was a little bit different. And we did okay. He was great. I mean, I don't think under him, I think I lost 4 or 5 games. I don't think I lost many games under him because of the team we had, and because he was an Italian, and Italians are normally defensively minded. But because of some of the teams we played against, we sort of won games, which was great.
So that actually is a good segue to my next question, actually, because I think you kind of half answered it. We always hear this rhetoric about Italian footballers and the style being defensively. We hear about Catenaccio and all that kind of stuff. Did you notice much defensive play or defensive tactics or training during your tenure?
Not a training. Training was all about being flamboyant and scoring goals. And, you know, we played, you know, 10v10 or whatever, or even 6v6 with 6 on the side or whatever we would have at the time, depending on how many trained. And it was all about scoring goals. It wasn't about defending or anything else like that. And, you know, enjoying training, having a smile on your face. But then when it got to the games, it was a stickler that you would have to defend properly. And it is a sort of niche that the Italians are meant to be well known for being defensively minded and defensively sound. And he was pretty much no different, especially against the top teams as well.
Okay, brilliant. I'm glad you summed that one up, because again, I know lots of people would have been asking me, why didn't you ask him about Trapattoni and his tactical nous? Because, you know, he's been at Bayern Munich, he's been at so many different clubs, and you'd have thought that, you know, he'd kind of use all of that experience to play for the national team, or to say coach the national team. But then again, it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it? You don't have the team every day like you would at club level. You've got them every few months and you've only got them for a short period of time and then they go back. So I guess it's very difficult to stamp some kind of system or philosophy in such a short space of time.
Which is why I think he let Robbie do what he whatever he wanted, really, because of...
Robbie.
Just purely and simply because he looked at us as the spine of the team. You know, like, say, Robbie, Shea, Richard Dunn, Damien Duff, you know, old senior heads of the team. And he would say, look, as long as you guys perform, we'll do well. And everybody else around you has got to live up to that level. So that was the idea of, I'm guessing, of his ways. And that was his tenure, really. It was all about that and enjoying it.
Speaking of Robbie Keane, did he get into any altercations with anyone? Because a little bird told me that he had a little bit of a scuffle with Edgar Davids while they were at Spurs. I mean, I don't know if you much about that.
Yeah, there was none of that while he was with Ireland. I've seen that as well. But no, I never saw that. Never really saw that side of him, to be honest. So that's not to say he hasn't got it. But obviously, he has got it if he's squaring up to Edgar Davids.
When you're at national team, though, you, pride's at stake, isn't it? So you're more focused on that.
Yeah, and listen, he was the biggest of the biggest names that Ireland have produced for a very, very long time. So he has a reputation to uphold, and didn't see him ever really losing his rag. He was more there to represent his country and enjoy it, I think.
Special striker, though. I remember him at Coventry, at Wolves. He had a spell at Inter, Spurs a couple of spells, Villa, Liverpool. I mean, I'm reading off the names of these clubs, LA Galaxy, but everywhere he went, he scored goals.
Top striker, mate. Really, really good. Probably, yeah, I'd say he's the best player I played with.
Really?
In terms of scoring goals, yeah, he had this niche and knack of finding space and the ball being attracted to him, which as a striker is very, very difficult, because you can make 100 runs and only one time it will find you. But he seemed to make 100 runs and 99 times it would find him. Look, you don't get signed to Liverpool for 20 million or whatever, 25 million it was, and Inter as a kid, and, you know, Spurs a couple of times, and, you know, you don't get signed for these sort of clubs if you're a one-hit wonder. You get signed for these clubs because you've got pedigree and because you're a top striker and you can score goals.
How do you coach that close control, though? Because I saw him on the touchline or on the byline and he could mega defender, no problem. And it's almost as if, you see Messi do it and you see other players, like all these world-class players. And Robbie Keane was never put up there. Do you get what I'm saying? I understand why. But as I said, the close control, he could, you know, not make a mermaid.
Yeah, he, honestly, he's, you can't coach it. You literally can't, because it's a knack that you have as a striker. If you can find space and you can, you know, go where the ball, you think the ball is going to land, and the ball land there, and you be the first one to react. You can't teach that. He just had it. And again, it was for him, he knew what his game was. Never the quickest, but in the box, he came alive. And to score over 100 goals in the Premier League, listen, that's no mean feat. I mean, I've scored over 100 goals in my career. He scored over 100 goals in the Premier League. That just shows the type of striker he was at that time, and he goes on and does it at every club that he's been at. So he's top striker, mate.
Brilliant. Okay, Martin O'Neill, he came in afterwards. Well, not after Trapattoni, I think it was after King, wasn't he? And in came another Keane, Roy Keane, a very outspoken person. I know you played several games. You were in the 2012 European Championship the actual squad itself for the main tournament, and you played against the likes of Modric and Ramos and Piqué and the best of the best. And granted, the results didn't go your way, but in terms of an overall experience, I mean, this is something that, you know, you're obviously going to talk to your kids and your grandkids about, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Was Trapattoni was still the manager when we went to 2012.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because he came, didn't he come in 2013 or something?
Yeah, 13. I think after the 2012, we obviously got knocked out. I think that was the time that Trapattoni left and we went down a new route. And yeah, Martin and Roy came in. Bit of good cop, bad cop sort of thing. And yeah, listen, Roy just has this aura about him. That scary aura that as soon as he walks into a room, you know he's there. And yet you sort of walk on eggshells because you don't want to do or say the wrong thing in case you get the Roy Keane wrath around you. but listen, he was fine. He was good as gold. He didn't, very rarely did he lose his shit at anything or anybody. Martin O'Neill. Did he learn
from his experiences at Ipswich and Sunderland?
Maybe, but I think also at those places he was a manager, so he could do it. Whereas when you're the number two, I don't think, you know, you have to go off with the manager. And the manager, Martin O'Neill, is not placid, but he's a little bit more relaxed in terms of shouting his mouth at something that's wrong. He would more have a word and have a conversation than shout about it. So he may have learned from there. Obviously still very outspoken on numerous things, but you listen to somebody who's had a career like he does, or he had. So it was a good time, but that was the end of 2000 or the start of 2014, the end of 2014 season at club level. So around May time was, end of 2013, May time, was my last time with the national team.
So let's just quickly go back to the Euros, right? You got that call up and you knew you were going to go to the tournament. What were you guys expecting from that group? Because it was a horrible group, Croatia, Spain and Italy. And I know you scored against Italy in a friendly.
Yeah.
Scored against Italy in a friendly. And I need to ask you before that, who kicked your ass when you were in the net?
Stephen Hunt.
I saw the goals and he booted him in the ass. What for? You've done your hammy as well. I swear you've done your hammy.
No, I collided with the post. Listen, it was great. Like the experience of being there, you asked what we'd expect to do while we were there. Not a lot, to be honest, bearing in mind the group we had. Croatia, Spain and Italy. And it says a lot about our group that Spain and Italy were the finalists that year. So,
Spain beat them without a striker, didn't they?
Yeah, that's it. Played Fabregas up front. You know, that was it. It was a time where Ireland hadn't qualified for Euros in 30 odd years or so. I think it might have been longer than that.
Yeah, it was in 1988 in Germany, I think it was.
So it was a long time. So we didn't expect anything. We went, obviously we tried our hardest, obviously in the games. But for me personally, being selected to go to a European Championships with your national team, probably the best career moment of my life. The whole build up to games, the whole build up to the tournament, being involved in the games, starting the Spain game, coming on in the Croatia game, coming on in the Italy game, just seeing the way that the tournament is and how it evolves. And like I say, the build up to games 3 days before, 2 days before, day before, day of a game, you know, that sort of thing. And listen, Irish fans who go to tournament football, you ask anyone who goes to tournaments, they're the best fans by a country mile, because they're there for a laugh and a joke and the beer and the social side of things. But when they go to the games, the sea of green, the, you know, inside the stadium, they never stop singing, they never stop, you know, encouraging and making sure that the team know that they're there. And it just, it set, like, I mean, I get goosebumps talking about it. It does send shivers through you. We got beat, Spain outplayed, like, by class, just pure class. And the Irish fans stayed in the stadium for about 45 minutes after the game finished, singing the Fields of Athlone Rye. Didn't need to, don't get any love for it at all, but that's what they're about. They're about just being there, being in the stadium, knowing that we could hear it, you know, and that sort of thing, it just sits with you. When you're there and you're in the bubble, you sort of don't really get to see it and feel it. But when you leave and you realise how much you noticed and you got to see and that, and it's, I mean, listen, mate, if you ever get to one, go. It's an amazing experience. Mm.
Do you know, what I find incredible about the Irish fans is that regardless of who it is, if they've represented Ireland at any level, they will back them no matter what. I mean, there's a manager called Mick McCarthy that joined our rivals a few months ago. And, you know, I wasn't very happy about it because, you know, I kind of liked Mick McCarthy before that, but now he's dead to me. but you know, the messages on social media from a lot of Irish fans saying, go on, Mick, you know, you could do well out there. Okay, you only lasted 2 months. And Jack Burnley is also out there at the moment. So I think Abel are going to have a lot of supporters, Irish supporters going to Cyprus maybe next season if they allow the fans back in, just to see Jack Byrne play. And it's this loyalty, as you said, they're all around the world. 94 World Cup in Germany, thousands of them.
Yeah,
everywhere they go, there's going to be thousands of them. And I find that kind of support incredible. And on top of that, you rarely hear of any trouble. Rarely hear of it.
Not there for it, though. They're not there for it at all. Like, they're there. They're there just for, they're there for the crack. They're there for just enjoying it and the experience of it. You know, they go, they enjoy, listen, probably the best drinkers you've ever seen. So they go there and drink themselves into oblivion, but then they'll get up the next day without any trouble and they'll go again. That's the mindset and the mantra of the typical Irish fan that goes to tournaments, because they might not even have a ticket. Like, majority of the people that go to tournaments, they don't have tickets. They go just for the atmosphere, the big screen in the city centre, the, you know, the fan zones and all that sort of stuff. They go for that. And if they're able,
I guess.
Yeah, if they go to a game, it's a bonus, but they are there for the memories.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. Well, that must be a fantastic chapter in your career and in your life.
Absolutely, mate. The best, like I say, the best experience as a footballer, I think you could ever have, apart from obviously winning something like a World Cup or Euros. But if you look and you're being honest with yourself, the likelihoods are of us winning that tournament was a little bit more than Leicester winning the Premier League, I'd imagine.
Cool. Well, look, one quick thing with regards to that tournament. As you said, you played against Spain and you had Ramos and Piqué, the central defenders. How difficult were they to play against in comparison to other defenders you played in the Premier League?
Just top draw, mate, to be honest. They were... it was just... Everything was an ease, like an absolute ease for them. Listen, I think... I've been to Madrid and watched Real Madrid play, and I've been to Barcelona and watched Barcelona play, and it just looks exactly the same. It looks such an easy game for them. The simplicity of the game. You get no change out of them as a striker. None. Every time you move, they know you're moving. Every time you stop, stand still, they're on you. Every time you turn, you got them facing you. It's literally everything that... everything that you expected to do, they've already thought of. They always seemed like one or two steps ahead of you. And that's just the nature that you were coming up against, the class that is both of them.
So which of the two would you say were the most difficult ones to play against? Because I'd have thought it would have been Ramos, because he's just a beast, isn't he? You don't go anywhere near him. He'll kick you.
Yeah, Ramos was always when anybody asked me about the best central defender I played against, whether that's domestically or internationally, he's always the one that I bring up. Like I say, just pure class, left foot, right foot, communication. As a central defender, he speaks really good English as well, so he would speak to you. So, and you'd be like blowing out your hole and he'd be like trying to talk to you and you'd be like, mate, shut up.
I'm taking the piss, man.
Yeah. you're cruising with a fag on and I'm blowing. Do you know what I mean? Like, relax. But yeah, no, he was top jaw and he's had an unbelievable career and he just is an all round top defender.
So which player do you think, looking back on your career, did you see and you thought, wow, this guy's unreal, he's out of this world?
It's tough, mate, because I played against, we played Austria, right? And this is really strange. I played Austria and David Alaba, right? Bayern Munich, left back, centre back at the time, was at Juve. I remember him playing left back. He came and played against us. He played central midfield. And I was just like, mate, you're a left back. Get back there. What are you doing in here? And it was really strange. But he was one who like sort of really surprised me. But then obviously you come up against your PKs and your Ramoses and your Xavis and Iniestas and that. Pirlo for Italy. You know, Chiellini, pure defender. Mate, you just come up against Modric and it's like, you have to understand that when I moved from Swindon to West Brom, that was a big step. Then you go from West Brom in the Championship to West Brom in the Premier League, even bigger step. And that happened within the space of 2 years.
2 years, yeah.
Then all of a sudden, 2010, so we got promoted to the Premier League in 2010. So then it was 2 years from then we went to the Euros. So 4 years, I'd gone from League One,
playing
Carlisle United away, yeah, to Ramos, Piqué, Pirlo, Iniesta, Xavi at the Euros in front of 70,000 people. The steps I took to get there, it's not one step or two steps. This is mountains. You know what I mean? This is like there. These are big, big steps. And
You took the lift.
Oh, if I could parachute up, mate, that was the way I was. You know what I mean? That was the way it worked. It was like, if I take anything from my career, it was like there was no bedding in period. It was like leap and see how you get on. And listen, I've had some unbelievable experiences in my career, but the time scale from getting there to there, I'd be very hard pushed to see anybody make that bigger step in that short amount of time.
I don't think even Jamie Vardy did it like that, did he? Because he went from non-league to Leicester and then a couple of seasons and then Premier League. And then, so it was about 5-6 years, if that, wasn't he?
Yeah, but I think he had a bedding in period at Leicester where, you know, he didn't play that often and sort of then, because he was there with Chris Wood for a bit and you know, they spent a bit of time in the Championship, whereas I spent one season. Then you spent two or three seasons in the Premier League, and then you get your international call up and then that's it. It's like, the one thing that I would love to have had, if I look back at my career, is that bedding in period at West Brom. If we didn't get promoted that first season, which, listen, I would never take it away, but if I take one thing away from my career, I would have loved to have one more year in the Championship, because I scored 9 goals, I think I scored that season when we got promoted. If we'd have not got promoted and I'd have stayed for one more year in the Championship, I reckon I would have gone on and scored, you know, 10 to 15 goals, maybe 20 goals with the players that we had there. I would have felt more of a Championship player. Wow. Before getting promoted, would have felt more of a complete Championship player, and then gone and thought, yeah, let's have a crack at the Premier League. Whereas I got 29 goals in League One, went to the Championship, scored 9 goals, and then 9 goals in the league. Then all of a sudden it was like, now you're a Premier League player. So I never really had that bedding in period. So I would love to have had that. But listen, my career went in one path and I'll never ever regret anything that I've ever done. So I can't begrudge my career so far. It's been great to me. And you know, long may I continue to be out there.
100%, mate. 100%. Well, look, there's a couple more questions before I wrap it up, because I've taken up almost an hour and a half of your time, and I really appreciate it, mate. Thank you very much. I know it's first thing in the morning out there as well. You probably want another coffee. Go around the golf book, do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Jeez, don't know, get in the way of that. But very quickly on Nottingham Forest, 2012, you joined the club. There was a lot of strikers there. Obviously, Darbs, Darius Henderson, Marcus Tugge, Dexter Blackstock, Billy Sharp. What was your thinking joining that club with so many strikers there?
So again, it was. I came back from the Euros. Steve Clark was a manager at West Brom at the time. He phoned me. Was the first person I saw when I walked back through the door at West Brom, and he was bringing in Romelu Lukaku to West Brom. So at the time, we had Peter Odemwingie, Shane Long, Marc-Antoine Fortuné, and then we were bringing in Romelu Lukaku. And he said, "Look, you're going to be fifth choice, so probably not going to play." Similar to what I had at Reading that first time around. And he said, "Look, you're probably not going to play that much. I think it's probably best if you try finding a club where you're going to play and prove my decision sort of wrong." And I was like, okay. So then there was a chance I was going to go to Blackburn, and I pretty much had the deal done. Then the owners decide to change their mind at the last minute. Changed their mind at the last minute. Then I met with the guys at Forest and I went there, and it was, like I say, it was up the road from Birmingham, so I could live at home for a bit, and then end up moving to Nottingham. But I was there to show that I'd come from a Premier League club and what I could do, and you know, it started off really well, but really petered out in the end, to be honest.
So was it Cottrell that signed you?
Yeah.
Then he obviously knew you from your time at Northampton, right?
Yeah, he was great, to be fair to him. Bit strange, but I got to know him actually really well, because I signed for him at Bristol City as well. And
Okay.
But he was great, mate, to be fair. He was great. Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank was his assistant. So it was a good time to start with, and then, like I say, it just sort of fell away at the end.
I think you had O'Driscoll there, McLeish, Billy Davis. Again, yeah. Four managers in
top anyway.
he's a good one. He's a good one. But came eighth that season, 1 point away from the playoffs. Where do you think it kind of went wrong for the club? Because when you look at the squad itself, you had Lansbury, Greening again, who you had at West Brom. Jermaine Genis came on loan from Spurs. So, yeah, where did it go wrong? Or where do you think? I'm not saying like you
know. No. It's tough, mate, because we had an owner, a Kuwaiti guy, who liked to sort of dabble in the ins and outs of the dressing room and everything else. And we signed two lads from one from the UAE and one from Kuwait, and it was all about trying to get them in the team as much as possible, and that sort of disrupted the momentum that we had at the time. And listen, two decent players, especially one of them, he was very good, but it just wasn't what we needed at the time. We were a group of people, a group of lads together who we could do something, and we had the ability in the dressing room to do something, especially like momentum is massive, and we had momentum at the time, and we just lost our way a little bit. I think it was around the sort of February, March time, we lost our way a little bit. Didn't pick up enough wins in the month, and as you said, we missed out on the final day. I think we needed to win, and I think we drew with Leicester 2-2, I think. And that was listen, if we'd have won, we'd have gone into the playoffs. And listen, playoffs is a lottery as itself. So we could have gone on to do something. But yeah, I think we just lost our way a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's a shame because this is a club that really does deserve to be in the Premier League. And much as I'm not a fan of their current owner, I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
At all, because I've got some friends that are Olympiacos fans and I don't want to upset them, but I'm not a fan of their owner. And but they've got Chris Hughton in charge, who's a fantastic head coach. Stephen Reid is also there at the moment helping out. So I think they've got a good nucleus there in terms of a coaching capacity. They've got a few decent strikers as well. One of them was at Charlton, who likes to step when he takes his penalties.
Kyle Taylor,
yeah.
And most nonchalant penalty taker, I think, ever to grace a football pitch.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting with him because, you know, he refused to play the back end of last season for Charlton, and that effectively cost them their place in the league. And on the one hand, I can see why, because, you know, he was out of contract. He was worried that he might get an injury and he might not play ever again. It's a short career. And while I understand the frustration of the fans, I can also see the player's perspective as well. When you do this media stuff, you speak to so many different footballers and you hear their stories, and some of them fall out of love with football at a young age. Some of them play till they're very old, or till they just don't know what else to do with their lives. And again, I'm deviating from the discussion here, but I still don't blame him for doing what he did.
No, not at all. And one thing I think he did well, though, is he came out and explained his decision. Because the worst thing for any football fan is for a player to make a decision and nobody explain why. You know, regardless whether you're going to get stick for it or not, or, you know, whether you're going to get a lot of plaudits for it or not, it doesn't matter. You make the decision which is best for you, your family, your career, you know, your trajectory, wherever you want to go in life. And he came out and explained it. He was like, look, we just had COVID. We're coming back to play. We've not done any work. I've been injured, had an operation, so on and so on. I've gone into lockdown, not really done anything. And I'm out of contract in the summer. I don't want to come back, get injured, because I've got a chance at a big contract, because that was one of the big things that Charlton couldn't offer him. He could go out and play in the Championship at a good club. And he explained his decision. And I don't think anybody really begrudges him for that, because ultimately he's made the decision for the right reasons in terms of himself, his family and his life.
There you go. And that's the thing. Family is more important than anything, really.
Absolutely.
You know, so, yeah. There you go. Right, mate. Listen, one more thing. You're at Western Sydney Wanderers, as we spoke about earlier. You've got a big game coming up against MacArthur. Now, I know you've done some goal celebrations in your past, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you do score against MacArthur, are you going to replicate Matt's one and just do the whole
salute? Ah, see, but I've done that over here. That was really? My celebration when I came over here. And then I got told the other day, like, when he scored his goal, when he did the old salute and that, and our CEO came out over to me and he was like, what about Derbyshire stealing your celebration? We've got heroes, haven't we?
There you go. He's going to be watching this. He's going to text you afterwards. I heard what you said about me. Yeah. Do you know what? It's quite interesting how your move to Western Sydney came about, because as far as I remember, you were approached by the then head coach. Was it Marcus Babbel that wanted you at the club? And that's an interesting one for me, because this is a player that played for Bayern Munich, for Liverpool, won five trophies while he was at Anfield. So that must have been a big feather in your cap, so to speak.
Yeah, I got spoken to by my agent, who said that there's a club in Australia, if you fancied it, that would love to take you. And I was like, I said, okay, let's talk to them. Let's listen to what they've got to say. I had a year left in my contract at Southend, so I couldn't leave, and naturally Australian clubs, they don't buy anybody. They're all players on free transfers or who haven't had a club for a little bit, who want to get back into football. And it was a chart, like, I had to try and get out of my contract at Southend. They wouldn't allow me to do that, but I sat down with my family, spoke with Marcus on the phone. Being a Liverpool fan, it was a big thing for me as well. You know, having somebody like that want to bring you into the football club and obviously speak to you on a level that is a manager and a player and sort of hear what he had to say. And ultimately, I still signed under him, even though he, you know, I never got to work with him. I still signed and I came out to watch the Perth Glory game that they got beat 1-0. And then, you know, unsurprisingly, the results weren't great before that. And he ended up moving on after that game. But yeah, it was a big thing for me. Having somebody who played for my boyhood club, Liverpool, phone me up and want to bring me in.
There you go. And you've been there for a year this season. I think you've got played, what, five games, third in the table. It's looking pretty good so far. And I know Carl Robinson, who was at, I believe, was he at Sunderland and Wolves?
He was coaching
at Newcastle. Was it Newcastle Jets before?
Newcastle Jets, yeah. He was over in Canada in the MLS as well, Vancouver.
He's got experience there. And also, who else is there? Graham Dorans.
One of my old teammates at West Brom. Yeah, he's now with us. Kenny Miller's his assistant as well.
Okay, excellent. What do you make of this season so far? Do you think you guys have got a chance of winning this title?
This is about as close as of a season that we'll do really well, because last year before, Sydney FC had sort of run away with the league, and Melbourne City, they sort of were the two teams that were there to be shot at, really. And because of COVID and because of, you know, circumstances, people have left the clubs and gone on to seek passes new and stuff. And we recruited really well. Like you said, Carl Robinson's a massive scoop for us, plays football the right way. Graham Dorans, great signing for us. He's about to come out of quarantine in a couple of days. So he'll add a different dynamic to us. We've got some really, really good players, mate. And we'll be really competitive this year. If there is ever a season that we would be up there, it'll be this year. As long as I said to you, momentum is a big thing in football. As long as we gain momentum at the right time and stay consistent throughout the season, we're a team who likes the ball, plays football the right way. And if we can score more goals than we let in, and we don't let in that many. We haven't conceded from open play yet this year, which is great. We want that to continue. Then we'll be a force this year, mate.
Great stuff. Well, mate, look, thank you ever so much for your time, man. It's been over an hour and a half and you haven't yawned once. So
don't worry about it.
I think it's gone well. But before I let you leave, do you have any social media, like Instagram, anything that you want to follow?
Yeah, so I've got Twitter and Instagram. So
my Twitter.
I did end up getting it. Yeah. So my Twitter, I'll get my phone out one sec. My Twitter handle is, I don't even know how you get it up now.
Let me get my
phone. There you go. It's SCoxy31 Real. And okay. Then my Instagram.
SCoxy31 Real. How many fake profiles have they got of you?
Nah, that's it. See, well, I had one that I cancelled and then they wouldn't let
you
me bring
it. Verified 18,000 followers. All right, then, Mr. Verified, Mr. Blue Tick. All right.
I don't really get you a great deal, the old Blue Tick, anymore. used to get you a few bits. It doesn't get you anything. And my Instagram, which is probably more the one platform I use most, is just SCoxy31.
Right, I'm gonna add you on that one as well. Here we go, right there. Boom.
So, I'm all about. I'm all about the Instagram, to be fair.
All right, mate. Well, look, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to wrap it up like that. So, Bethia, I'm going to do it all in Greek. Until next time, Bamishilakamo.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.